Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Jimmy from Neptune, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you guys for having me. Lauren, thank you for asking me. She just came out and did a great job at our home group, which is Solution on the Shore in Neptune, New Jersey. I love my home group, but I love it. I love Pennsylvania AA. I got sober in Pennsylvania in Bucks County. I think in New Jersey there's a little bit more like tough love, I guess you call it, in the AA meetings. But you know, you guys are some really nice people, so thank you for having me. And my sobriety date is January 13th, 2011. You know, I say I'm an alcoholic. That means a few things to me. The first thing is I got this phenomenon of craving to alcohol. It's very simple, because I came into AA, you know, with a lot of different problems, you know, and I always thought I had to get everybody to understand me so I could get the best help suited for me, you know what I mean, when I came here. And, you know, I'm just an alcoholic. When I pick up a drink, I don't know when I'm going to stop. A lot of the times, you know, I like to drink for oblivion, but there were some times where I said, you know, I'm only going to have a few drinks. You know, I got work tomorrow. My mom just let me come back into the house. She's going to kick me out again. But after a few drinks, it's like I'll come up with a story for my mom later. And then I start thinking clearly after a few drinks. I'm like, I didn't really like that job that much to begin with, you know, and, the next drink is way more important than anything else. I guess to illustrate, there was one time I was coming home from a recovery house. I've been to many recovery houses, rehabs, and things like that. My mom let me come back in. She laid down all these rules for me. You have to stay sober, obviously, go to meetings. She wanted to keep my job. I had a job at Walmart. And take a class at the community college. So the day I get home, though, I make a decision to pick up a drink with my buddy Dave down the street. I say, you know, we're only going to have a few beers. And I go down the street to see my buddy Dave. You know, we start drinking. We're drinking some beers. We're smoking some other stuff. Then all of a sudden, you know, I'm doing some other non-conference approved substances. You know, I'm drinking hard liquor. It's time to go to my night class. And I'm too drunk to go to my night class, so I keep drinking. My mom said, you know, you have a curfew if you want to stay with us. But it's getting close to the time where I got to be home. And I get a great idea to go do some other non-conference approved stuff that I haven't done in a while, in some questionable neighborhood. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm in a boarding house, you know, with some stranger I just met. You know, my mom's probably up wondering where I am, but it's like, oh, I started this night off saying I was just going to have a few beers with my buddy Dave, you know, and I'm in this, place. I get home. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. My mom's like, first thing in the morning, you're out. I get this great idea to steal my mom's car overnight. I steal my mom's car. I go out for a couple more days. I'm with these questionable people, and I wake up in the back of the car with them, and they had this idea to rob these salesmen. They were selling like illegal substances, and you know, I'm just in the back of the car with them, and we proceed to be on a high speed car chase, you know, and the whole time I'm thinking like, yo, I gotta pee, I gotta use the bathroom, and we're riding through Route 88 down in Ocean County, New Jersey. The cops get involved. One of the kids jumped out of the car with all the stuff. The cops get involved. The kid's aunt comes and takes the truck we were in. It was her truck, but I leave the car keys to my mom's car in the truck, You know, so now my mom's keys are in this truck and the lady won't give me the keys. Instead of calling my mom, I'm like, you know, let me take it on the run for a few more days. You know, so that all ends up, I come to, I'm on my buddy's porch down the street from my, where my brother was staying at the time. He comes and, picks me up with that regular look of disgust, you know, and he's like, come on, let's go. He lets me sleep it off at his house. Then the next day, it's like, so I'm so humiliated, ashamed. I gotta call my mom, like, retrace all my steps, you know, get my mom or, you know, go with my mom down to get her car back. And it was like I was only going to have a couple beers with my buddy Dave, you know, and that's what the phenomenon of craving is to me. But the even more baffling part of my alcoholism is even after all that's said and done, I make a decision to do it again, you know, and that's the insanity of alcoholism. You know, that mental obsession, you know, it doesn't matter how long I've been separated from it, you know, how bad the consequences were, how many people I hurt, you know, how strong I've made plenty of resolutions, like I'm never going to do this again, tears in my eyes. I'm sure a lot of you have heard the expression, you know, you could have hooked me up to a lie detector test and I would have passed. I really would have, you know, I really didn't want to. You know, the pain caused by all the craziness from when I was drinking, you know, it's pretty strong at the beginning. But, you know, the truth is, like, after I'm sober a couple of days, you know, for a little bit, you know, I start, you know, it doesn't matter how bad that resolution was. Like, I can't stand the feeling of sobriety. You know, I get, restless, irritable, discontent. Like our literature says, cause that, you know, what this all really stems from, you know, I learned here in AA, you know, when we open up the big book and we, get into the third step, you know, we talk about, you know, what my real problem is selfishness and self-centeredness, you know, and I'm this, you know, there's a lot of different descriptions in AA, like, you know, spiritual malady, egomaniac with an inferiority complex, you know, something I've always identified with, you know, I couldn't put words to it until I came here, but as soon as you described me here, you know, I identified with that, you know, I can't stand how I feel in my own skin, and, you know, until I experienced, you know, the spiritual experience that we have here in AA, the only solution I knew for that was alcohol. And some other, like I said, non-conference approved things that I did, helped. But, you know, I was, you know, I had a lot of alcoholism in my family. I'm not saying that doesn't, you know, that's not the, deciding factor. I don't think if you're an alcoholic, but, you know, I did have a lot of alcoholism in my family. You know, I had, you know, my father in and out of jail and rehabs. You know, all through my childhood and teens, I had, my mom, you know, she doesn't have a problem with alcohol. You know, she's definitely suffered from other people's alcoholism. Her mom, my dad, you know, my older brother and me, my mom had a black belt in Al-Anon, you know, by the time I started getting in trouble, you know, there wasn't a lot of, enabling going on, you know. I shouldn't even say enabling. It was hard for me to manipulate her, I should say. You know, I hated alcohol. I saw what it did, you know, to my dad. You know, my dad showing up, on Christmas at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, yelling at my mom, you know, I seen things escalate, and I saw all the consequences of alcoholism. You know, I had every reason not to pick up a drink. You know, my mom used to drag me to these Al-Anon meetings when I was a kid, and I knew a lot about alcoholism. You know, my mom used to tell me it's an illness. You know, your dad, he, you know, it's not that he doesn't love you, it's just that he's sick, and, my grandmother would say to me, like, you should learn from their mistakes so you never pick up a drink in your life, you know. So by logic, you know, I shouldn't have ever picked up a drink, but like I said, it wasn't a social thing in my house. It wasn't like a big thing at parties. It was always looked at as a negative thing. If someone picked up a drink, the cops were getting called. Something dramatic was happening. And, I saw its ugliness. But, I grew up in this town, Franklin Township, New Jersey. I always had that problem. My dad, whenever I got in trouble in school or I acted out, I always had these behavioral problems as a kid. That was always the one thing I could, pin it on, use that as a crutch, poor me kind of thing, and I was always seeing counselors and things like that, being put on medication. And I grew up in this town, in my neighborhood. It was very, like, diverse town, a lot of different types of people there. But I always felt different, I always, in my neighborhood, I didn't feel like I fit in. I felt like my friends had this other kind of bond. They could relate, they could relate with each other on, and I always, I mention all these circumstances, but, I was so wrong, I always had a story for why I acted the way I did and why I felt the way I did. It's all these outside things, but I never, I never knew until I got here, it's something deeper than that. It's this, spiritual malady that we talk about. But, we moved. My mom, she pretty much raised me and my brother by herself. When I was, 12 years old, we moved from this town to Basking Ridge, New Jersey, which is a very nice town, rich town, very wealthy. And I thought, when I move here, that's when I'm going to be happy. I'm going to have my new start. And I remember, I was talking with my, with Corey on the way. Thank you, Corey. I forgot to thank you for coming with me. But, I was talking with him about, this double life that it talks about in the Big Book. And I could remember, before I even picked up a drink, I was thinking, when I move up to this town, I'm going to put on this whole front. When I get up there, I'm going to reinvent myself. I'm going to be cool. I'm going to be like rebel without a cause, I'm gonna put on this big bravado for all these rich kids, and I moved up there, and I was getting in trouble all the time. I wasn't making friends in middle school. I was just so miserable, and I always felt so alone, and I was always acting out, and I never I couldn't fit in. But I liked hanging out with the older kids. The older kids, they thought I was funny. They thought I was cool. I don't know what it was. I think I was just there for their amusement. They were like bigger kids, older kids, and they used to all beat the crap out of me. And I thought they were initiating me. You know what I mean? They were making me part of their crew. And, I got to hang out with them, and they were all always down by the basketball court in our neighborhood. They were always drinking and smoking pot, and they all had these same Honda Civic with subwoofers in the back, and they were always down there listening to their music loud. Sometimes kids would go there to fight late at night, and they were hanging out with girls. And they let me hang out with them, and they let me drink with them for the first time. And that was a life-changing thing for me. We were drinking the good stuff, Keystone beers. I had a few of these Keystone beers with them. They said, Jim, just give me $5. You can drink as many as you want out of my trunk. And I remember after a few of those beers, you know, it just felt like the weight of the world got lifted off of my shoulder. You know, I remember there was like a big patch of woods across the street from our development we lived in. And I was looking across the street and I was like, oh, I never noticed how beautiful that was before, you know? And, I felt like the camaraderie around these guys, and I wasn't afraid about what they thought about me. You know, I just said whatever was on my mind, which wasn't always a good thing, but, you know, I was talking to the older girls. Like, it was cool. I loved it. I loved the feeling that, alcohol gave me. And, I think my mom came down that night and was like looking for me, and I was like trying to hide under one of the cars, and I was just all drunk, acting silly. And, you know, this is one thing I noticed later on, but, you know, after a few beers, I was like, you know, this is an amazing feeling. I love the way this feels. But I also remember this thought that actually became a lot more stronger in my drinking later on, which was, you know, I wonder what the next one's going to do, you know? And they were like, Jim, we'll give you your money back if you stop drinking, you know? And I just wanted to keep drinking, because I just loved it. But you know, later on, that feeling of the next one became more of like what I mentioned, like a phenomenon of craving, like I needed it. And, you know, it was like I needed the 10th one way more than I needed the second one. And, it was always intensified and never satisfied. But I remember the next day thinking, if I could feel like that 24/7, life would be great. And for me, things progressed very quickly. You know, I know that's not everybody's story, but, you know, I was very young, and, I was drinking. I couldn't really see, you know, I thought I just had a problem with drugs, but even back then I was drinking, you know, I was drinking a lot, and I was also pretty addicted to some other non-conference approved substances. Most 14-year-old kids, I don't think, find themselves, you know, like smoking crack and like stealing stuff from the house. You know, my mom bought me a digital camera the year before. I remember I was like selling stuff, like selling my PlayStation. You know, I was hanging out with this older guy in my neighborhood who, you know, he was like, you know, I guess my role model at the time. He would tell me to, like, you know, go in your house and take stuff. And I stole, you know, I remember I stole like $1,000 from my grandpa in like a week. And, it was like $50 at a time. Like, I remember I went into where he was hiding his money, and he was like born in Greece, like during like civil war and like craziness. So he didn't like trust, like he kept all of his money on him. And, I remember, like, I couldn't believe that I took all that money. Like, I took like $50 from my grandpa's stash, and I was like, I had a little part-time job at Burger King, you know? And I was like, I'll put the money back on my paycheck, you know? And I soon lost that job after things started getting, like, crazy. But, you know, there was all this money missing, and I couldn't believe that I took it all. And I wasn't coming home until like 3 o'clock in the morning. I wasn't sleeping at night. You know, it just got out of hand very quickly. I remember, one night I was partying. I was partying all night with my friends. I had a wrestling tournament in high school, and, it was right when those Monster Energy drinks came out, and I was partying all night with so-called friends, I guess. But we were, you know, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning when I got home. I had to get up at 6 a.m. to to get on the bus to go to my wrestling tournament. I remember just feeling like crap, like no one wanted to sit next to me on the bus. And I just like, I stunk. And it was my dad. I called my dad up and I'm like, "Dad, bring me one of those monster things they got." And I remember I chugged this monster energy drink like right before my wrestling match in the tournament. And I went and my dad's like yelling at me. He was just out for like 2 weeks. He was all messed up and he's like drunk yelling at me like, "You're going to get your ass kicked. Like, what are you doing?" And I go out there and I pin the kid in 30 seconds. You know what I mean? And then my dad's like, "That's my son," you know, like, and like my coach is like, "Who is that guy?" But it was like, this couldn't be a problem, you know, because I was just partying all night before on no sleep, you know, like I just remember like reinforcing that idea, like this isn't a problem. But you know, it soon did become a problem. I get violent, you know, with my mom and my grandpa, you know, very shameful things. I just turned into a different person. And, you know, I couldn't see like what alcohol and drugs were doing to me. I could only see what they were doing for me. And the normal people in my life, you know, the people that care about me, they're only seeing what it's doing to me. They can't see what it's doing for me, you know, and I I'm thinking like, if you guys knew how this made me feel, like you would just all get off my back. You know, this is my answer to life. And, but it became a big problem. And, you know, I remember my mom had me committed to the psych ward. I thought she was being a very unreasonable. But the night before, I actually could see that things were getting kind of out of hand. I just started to realize like I had no control, you know, and I wanted to stop, but I couldn't stop. And, my mom had me put in the psych ward, but the next day, of course, I'm thinking like I was making too much of a big deal out of that. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I'm 14 years old. I'm in the psych ward. I'm like, I should be in school. You know, I wasn't showing up to school, but I'm thinking I should be in school. I don't belong here. And, but I get used to places like that, you know, when someone else is running my life, you know, after a couple days, you know, they get me on the right medication. There's not a whole lot of responsibility. They tell you when to eat, you know, there's free time, you know, we're sitting in a room like, you know, half the size of this pavilion, and we're playing cards, and we're watching Animal Planet, and you know, then I start like working my way up the ranks, you know, in those places. I become like level 2. They let you stay up 10 minutes later than everybody else and go in the game room. Then level 3. They let you walk to the vending machine. And then when you're really doing big things, like the final level, like they let you walk out in the parking lot for 10 minutes, you know, before it's time to go to bed. And, I just got used to that kind of structure. And, you know, I was only in there for a couple weeks, but, I remember thinking when I get out of here, things are going to be so much different. Like I really meant it. I felt all this positivity and motivation, you know, when I, and like this positive reinforcement. And the day comes when my mom comes and signs me out, and I'm walking through the long hallways of this psych ward. And by the time I get out into the parking lot, you know, all this confidence, I'm getting in a fight with my mom, you know, cause she doesn't want to take me to go hang out with my friends who I know I want to go get drunk with. It's like all this confidence and, resolution that it's like it never happened, you know, and I feel restless, irritable, and discontent, and I don't know why, and, I'd go to alcohol, and I was in and out of a lot of places. I was in a therapeutic community for 14 and a half months. That's like a place where they break you down and build you up. It was all throughout my teens. But, you know, they told me I was going to be there for 3 to 4 months, and most of it was going to be done in outpatient, you know. So I was like, all right, I'll go along with this. And then they tricked me, because when I got to the place, they said, we think you need long-term treatment. It's going to be 6 to 8 months. And then I'm in there for like 14 and a half months. And, I was in there, and it was like a lifetime movie or something, you know. It was like, I was like really like defiant when I got in there, you know. I didn't want to comply with the rules. I was always sitting on the bench, like the prospect bench. I don't know if you guys know like TC stuff, TC lingo, if any of you ever been to a therapeutic community. But, you know, I was going like, they would stand me up in front of all the kids, like 70 kids, and they would like yell at me and break me down, and then they would let the kids yell at you, and like, and then I had like this turnaround, and it was like a movie, like I said, like where I just broke down, and I was like, I need help, you know. And they made me go down the hallway. They're like, scream on the top of your lungs, you need help. And I'm like, I need help. And it was the real deal. And I there's all these statuses, and at that time I was shot down, and then I became like the coordinator of the rehab, and I'm telling all the other kids what they need to do. And a drink, you know, just seems impossible when I get out of here. Because at the same time, I feel like in our book, they talk about the story with Roland Hazard, goes to see Carl Jung, stays with him for a year, learns the inner workings of his mind, you know, relapse is unthinkable. And that was the same thing with me. I met with these counselors, and I really thought, like, you know, relapse was unthinkable when I get out of here. But the only thing they told me to go to AA meetings once I started to re-enter into society. But I would go to these AA meetings on my home passes. They start letting you go on a home pass towards the end, and I hear people talking about God and sponsor, and I'm like, God, like, I don't need any of that stuff. Like, I know the answer. I just went through this whole thing. And that's good for you guys, but I'm going to do this on my own. And I'm like, I'm just like a 16-year-old kid. I'm sharing at the meetings, you know, telling all these old people, like, what they got to do. And, you know, it wasn't good. And when I got out, I went to this meeting. It was in Belmar, close to where I live, Belmar, New Jersey, beach town. And my parents go with me to this meeting, and it's like in this dingy basement. There's, you know, it's not a beautiful setup like this, but it was like in this, it was in the perfect setup. I mean, my meeting's like that too, but it's like in this dingy basement. And you know, mediocre coffee, cold metal chairs, and these old fishermen dude, like, and my parents came with me, and I'm 16 years old getting out of this therapeutic community, and I'm thinking, if this is what my life is gonna be like, you know, I'd rather be drinking, you know? If my life is, you know, in here with these guys, like, you know, what's the point of being sober? So I came in and out of AA for a long time, and you know, I was going to a lot of meetings in the beginning, where I would hear a lot of people talk about, you know, the importance of a home group and commitments, all very important stuff, which I, you know, you know, right now I have a home group. I don't know if I said it's Solution on the Shore in Neptune, New Jersey. You know, I have a commitment there. I have, you know, I think it's, you know, we got to pull our weight here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it's not some like higher entity, you know, controlling this all. It's a self-supporting program. But, you know, there was a lot of talk about the importance of a group and stuff like that. But, you know, I didn't really hear a whole lot about the 12 steps. You know, there was a lot of people, you know, talking about, stay away from the big book thumper. But you know, there was, you know, even after that, you know, I got introduced with some great people, you know, that tried to take me through the steps. And I really fell in love with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, after I was introduced to the big book. My story isn't like I worked the steps and lived happily ever after. You know, I went to, I remember there was this, girl at, she was like 17 and I was 16, and she came and spoke at our home group, and I thought, like, you know, she's the only other teenager in AA, like, this is meant to be, me and her, you know? So she was like, come to my home group. And I came to her home group one night, instead of going to talk to her, this guy approached me in a parking lot, this guy Chris, and he started talking to me about, you know, about the big book, you know, about the steps. And you know, I was trying to do a four step. I was trying to do it all on my own, because I didn't really know, like, who, you know, I didn't know who was gonna help me with that. And this guy, you know, he brought me to his apartment one night, and you know, he saved my life, you know. You know, the first time I sat with, I did a fifth step with this guy, and I feel like there was this presence in the room that I never felt before. You know, I had been carrying around this stuff that happened to me when I was younger, and I remember feeling so ashamed, like, I'm not a real man, like, I'm not masculine. And I shared this stuff with him, and he told me, like, some stuff. And I remember feeling for the first time, like, yo, I'm not so unique, you know? And I, you know, the other thing with that is, like, I always thought, you know, I was such a victim, you know, my whole life, but I started to see how my actions were hurting other people. So, you know, this guy, I'm like in high school at the time, and he's running around, we're going to meetings, and people are like, you shouldn't be working the steps that fast with this guy. But he's taking me around with him all over the place. And I'm just, and all these, he brought me up back to North Jersey where I'm from. And he took me to make all these amends. And, all this great stuff is happening in my life. My father gets sober. My older brother is getting sober. And I just really start to fall in love with AA. But I'm in high school at the time, and, after a year sober, you know, looking back now, I started to notice, you know, I'm still afraid to get up and go to school in the morning, you know, like, I don't want to go to school. That's where all the kids are, you know, talking about partying and things like that. And, I'm like, trying to, like, talk to the new girls in AA, you know, I'm not really practicing the principles of the program. And my mom's like, you have school in the morning, you have to do your homework. And I'm like, I gotta go save this kid's life in AA, like, you don't understand. I start to, get depressed, and, I start to, believe these, I start to have these thoughts like, you know, you're way too young to be an alcoholic. You know, like, you just had a phase, you know, you did some pretty hard drugs, you know, you got in trouble, you're in high school, you should be able to drink and have fun, innocent fun, where I see, like, other kids taking drinks with impunity, you know, I don't think I really fully understood what it meant to be powerless over alcohol. I went out and I had a drink after like a couple weeks after celebrating a year sober. You know, I had been thinking about it for a long time and I did it. It was like 2 weeks of fun. And then it was like the madness never stopped, you know. Up until that point in AA, I was like the poster boy AA. You know, I was like the young kid. I got sober. You know, everybody was nice to me. You know, that's not always the case. You know, once you get older, I found not everybody's nice to you in AA. Oh, all right. Oh, is this for me? You know, I'm ashamed to go back. It was just so hard. It was like I would go to AA on Sunday, get a sponsor, not really call them, and then by Thursday night I'm already thinking about how I can get drunk again, that just repeated over and over again. And on my 18th birthday, my mom, she kicked me out of the house, I felt, you know, I started doing the recovery house shuffle. You know, I'd go into all these different recovery houses. I'd go back to AA. I'd go on these runs and, you know, I like crash and burn real quick. And I know I can always go back to the AA clubhouse. There's going to be someone there to, you know, buy me a pack of cigarettes, buy me a meal at the diner, and, I can hang out there. And, people in AA always trying to help me, and me always kind of taking their kindness for weakness. You know, I remember I went to this recovery house up in Massachusetts. This guy, he came and was speaking at this meeting in New Jersey, and his sponsee, these were some great, like, altruistic people, that were really about this program. And they were like, you could come live with us. We'll pay your rent, until you get a job. You know, we'll buy you food and cigarettes. You know, when you have the opportunity to help someone else, you can do it. And, I was surrounded by these, like, really great people. Like this guy, Tom F, like, was up there, and I talked to this guy for hours about, like, spirituality but after 2 months of freeloading at this recovery house, I finally get a job, and instead of going to pay my rent, I steal my roommate's car while he's doing his four step, I convince another kid to come with me just to save face. I didn't think about this until I was like a few years sober. But, like, this kid was brand new in the house and was all gung-ho about sobriety. And I, like, really worked this kid to come out with me, you know, just so I wouldn't get caught, you know. Obviously, like, yeah, I didn't force him to do anything, but, you know, he really tried to resist, you know. And I was like, no, let's go. And, you know, we went out, and, you know, that's, you know, it's like so many people in AA tried to help me, and, I was always like throwing it back in their face. But I'm staying with my, you know, towards the end, I'm staying with my dad. He's like a year sober at the time. I'm sleeping on his floor in, New Brunswick, one bedroom apartment. We live right next door to probation. My father's trying to be a single father at the time. He's we have Dyfus involved in the household because my little brother Thomas was just born. That's a long story, but you know, we have my dad on drug court, facing, you know, 5 years in prison for some kind of conspiracy thing. And, I'm not thinking about, you know, we're right next door to probation or the Dyfus workers coming in unannounced. I'm not thinking about the well-being of my newborn little brother. You know, my dad, he didn't even want me to hold him in the hospital. Because while he goes to work, I'm like lying to him, I'm stealing from him, and I'm going out, and it's just not fun anymore. And I'm just walking around New Brunswick, just like, alcohol just isn't working, you know? And I remember I was walking through, I was walking down George Street in New Brunswick, and I was like a mess at that point. But I was kind of tweaking out a little from some other stuff, and I look into the bar and I see these college kids drinking in the bar, and they're having a good time. They're pointing and laughing at me, and I remember thinking like, Jim, you're a real loser. And I'm just jealous, envying them. How come they're in there having a good time, partying, having innocent fun, and I'm out here on the street, you know, hurting myself, hurting my family? No matter how many times I was in and out of AA, I always felt like it was circumstances. You know, under different circumstances, I'd be able to drink normally. And at this point, I had burned bridges with everyone. My mom told me not to come back to the house. My brother, I had burned bridges with him. He was sober for like a year, and I'm in his house, you know, not being sober. And it was just like, I can't drink normally. Like, I can't control and enjoy my drinking. There was some guy who had been trying to get me to go out to this recovery house in Bristol, Pennsylvania. And I was kind of fighting him tooth and nail, because at this point I'm like, AA doesn't work, rehab doesn't work, recovery houses, they don't work, you know, they don't work for me. But this guy was just like me. He was in and out all the time, and he was out, away in Bristol, in this program, and something was different about him this time. You know, he was coming back to New Jersey, and he was making amends to people. And when I was standing there in New Brunswick, like, feeling hopeless, that was like the little bit of hope I had left. Like, if this could still work for him, maybe it could still work for me too. And I came out there to Bucks County, Bristol, Pennsylvania, and I just went out there with a whole new attitude. Like it says in our book, you know, we got to bring honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to the table. And I always come to AA. I love how you read that set aside prayer, you know, because I always come to AA thinking I know everything. Like, I've read the big book before, you know, I have a lot of good knowledge about AA. But for some reason I can't stay sober. And, I had the gift of desperation, as they call it, those corny acronyms. Because I was desperate enough, I think I was able to accept the help that people were trying to offer me. The first guy that asked, you know, offered me sponsorship, you know, I said, let's go, you know, let's do this. And he brought me through the 12 steps, and I don't know what my thoughts were, you know, about God at the time. But I remember hearing people share these, like, this corny thing they would share about gravity. They would be like, you know, you don't have to believe in gravity, but if we go out on this roof right here and we jump, whether you believe in gravity or not, gravity's gonna work. And it's the same thing with God. Like, whether you believe in God or not, if you work these 12 steps, you will have a spiritual awakening. And, you know, at this point, I'm beaten up enough, you know, I identify with you people. You guys drank like me. You understood what it meant to be the pain of sobriety, you know, because I've always had so many people in my life say, you know, if you just stop drinking and get it together, things are going to be okay. And whenever I stop drinking, it's not okay. I don't feel okay. And you guys are talking about that restless, irritable, discontent that it talks about when we're untreated alcoholics. And I trust you, you know. For the first time in my life, I had been talking to, you know, family members, drug and alcohol counselors, other people of authority. I could never trust them, you know. And it's like, you guys know how to get to me on a different level. You know, it's like you're the same. You know, I always felt there was some kind of moral authority whenever I was talking to, a counselor or something like that. But when I talk to you, it's like you're a screw up just like me, you know? It's okay. But your lives are better. And that's, you know, where it is. Like, if this can work for you, maybe it can work for me too. That's all the second step was for me in the beginning. And, I went through the steps. I wrote an inventory. You know, I saw how much of a victim I really was not. I thought I was a victim. I always think about this movie from the 90s with Michael Douglas. It's called Falling Down. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's like Michael Douglas is, and it's got Robert Duvall as the cop, and Michael Douglas is like, he's like at his breaking point, and he's like so fed up with, you know, society. And he faces like a gang, and like he kills a skinhead, and he's like, he's gonna bring good customer service back to he like shoots up the fast food restaurant, the Whammy Burger, and he's like he sees like the downfall of society, and he like wants to correct it. Like he sees like these rich guys at the country club, and it's like all this crazy stuff. And, you know, at the end, he's like, wait a second, I'm the bad guy, you know? And that's how it was for me when I did my fourth step, like at my fifth step with my sponsor. I looked at all this stuff and I'm like, wait, I'm the bad guy, you know? Like, I'm not the good guy. I'm not the victim. And my attitude kind of just changes. And I go out and I make amends to my family. And I don't know, it was like, I started to notice, like, when I go home and my mom started inviting me home, you know, I felt like less entitlement. Like, I didn't feel like this sense of entitlement. You know, I was always like, Mom, I'm in a jam. Can you give me some money, please? I need some money to pay off my rent at the recovery house. It was, you know, Mom, what can I do for you? You know? You know, it was like I says in our literature, it says we're always critical of ourselves and forgiving of others. And that's not to like beat up on myself, but I've watched my own actions and how I'm treating the people around me. And when somebody, you know, like in my family or something throws some, you know, crap at me, you know, I give them a pass. You know, I forgive them. Cause I put my family through so much, you know, through so much, pain, restless, you know, restless nights, you know, stealing, and, you know, it's my job to be the good son. And I, you know, I remember I was visiting my mom at home one night, and I'm in the house, and my mom had these, like, bottle of muscle relaxers, like, sitting on her desk. She doesn't have a problem with drugs or alcohol or anything like that. And my first thought at the time was, like, impulsive, like, oh, let me grab those and take them. And I poured these out in my hand, and I don't know what came over me. You know, it was a bad situation to be in, but I'm sitting there and I'm praying and I'm saying, God, I don't want to do this, but I do. And I got this weird sensation that just came over me, and it was like the impulse was just removed and I dropped them. And I got this like overwhelming feeling, like I don't need like a drink or a drug to feel okay. And I woke up the next morning, I called my sponsor, you know, to tell myself like, you know, I almost took my mom's medication. And he was like, hey, Jim, that's the 10th step promises coming true in your life. When tempted, we recoil from it like a hot flame. And I told my mom about it, and I'm thinking she's going to be mad at me. And she's not mad at me. She's like, you know, maybe you just weren't ready for all that. You know, we're happy with you know, what you've become. And I just remember I fell in love. Like, I felt on fire for AA, and I just wanted to pay this message forward to anybody who would listen. And since January 13, 2011, I'm always in a detox or a facility, a rehab, something like that. Cause I was in plenty of places like that myself. You know, I'm always, trying to reach my hand out for sponsorship and take someone else through the 12 steps. Cause it's like I learned in here, like my real problem is me. You know, it's that selfishness and self-centeredness. And, you know, I always have these like problems, I think, in my life. You know, I've been employed like since I've been sober, but you know, I've had problems. Like I've been like in school, like I had problems. Like I remember I was a few years sober. I got put on academic suspension from college, and I was like ashamed. Like I can't tell people in AA that I did that. You know, I've had problems like with relationships and things of that nature. And when I'm getting out of myself to help another alcoholic, it's not like all those things go away, but it's like I get out of myself just enough, you know, to where God can come in and do the work. And I get these, you know, through inventory and things like that, you know, I'm able to, you know, get through all these other affairs. But, you know, in that time, when I'm sitting down and working with another alcoholic, I get these islands of relief, you know, and I'm not feeling the pain of myself. And, you know, I'm feeling useful, and I'm, you know, I have purpose in my life. You know, I guess it's almost 9 o'clock, but, I really appreciate you guys having me. That's all I have. Thank you.